Hi there, I'm Avi Lewis.
And I'm Maya Menezes. And you're listening to Change Everything, a podcast by people who are freaking out about climate, racism, and inequality, and thinking through solutions that are actually as big as the crises we face.
So we're back. Maya, it's been a while since we've been in the podcast ring.
It's been a minute.
Here we are in the cold light of 2020, and I just want everybody to know that we are only doubling down on our fixation on the fast-evolving Green New Deal. In fact, here at The Leap, where we both work, we are launching a bunch of different collaborations around the Green New Deal in specific areas. So we're starting to think about a vision for a Green New Deal for food. What would that look like? A Green New Deal for transit, a Green New Deal for the world, the global Green New Deal, to bring the world into the Green New Deal conversation, and working with amazing partners. You'll hear more about it as we go through 2020. Today, we're going to kick it all off with a conversation about a Green New Deal for housing.
Yeah, it feels very Oprah-esque. Like, you get a Green New Deal under your seat. Everyone gets a Green New Deal. You get a Green New Deal.
There must be a Green New Deal for all. Come on.
The exciting thing for me in talking about housing is really it feels like the next big battlefield for what it means to see the future as a public good. You know, if we all deserve the right to a healthy planet, surely that includes the right to healthy homes, to safety. And so housing for all is also, I think, a really good threat and a very serious threat to the elite, to the establishment, and to runaway capitalism. You know, we really do pose an incredible threat to business as usual in this framework. And foundationally for me, I think if we're challenging all these systems of oppression that push people into poverty and push people into homelessness, then this is actually one of the most powerful ways that we can decolonize ourselves. And Indigenous rights are such a huge part of this. I mean, I think it was in last October, the UN Special Rapporteur on Housing reported that Indigenous housing conditions around the world are, quote, overwhelmingly abhorrent and part of an ongoing legacy of colonialism. And for me, when I think locally about what that means for the Indigenous communities close to my home, I think about Grassy Narrows, a community that I've had a lot of I've been very honored to work with, to see, to do work in the city with, advocacy work in Toronto with, who've been poisoned by mercury and have been advocating for a mercury home paid for by the government just to allow their communities to die together peacefully and not in less pain. And even then, the government will not give them a house, a home, because Indigenous self-determination is the greatest threat to the Canadian state, as it is in many places around the world. And so when we think about homelessness, we have to think about this is an issue incredibly on the rise, largely claimed by anti-poverty advocates as their issue. You know, climate people, I think, for a long time didn't see housing as a climate issue, but it is, of course. Mm-hmm. In Toronto, where I live, we've got over 8,000 people that are homeless, the same number as the Bay Area and San Francisco.
Incredible.
This is a crisis point in so many cities across North America and around the world. And so it feels like everyone's talking about housing, but no one's talking about housing.
Right.
But a couple of like stories that are really coming up for me, because, you know, while the issue is getting worse, the fight back is also getting more powerful. And right now in Oakland, California, we have Moms for Housing, which is a collective of Black mothers who were occupying vacant homes in Oakland, and they recently have won their battle to be able to purchase.
Such a sweet moment. Wasn't it a great story?
Yeah, it was incredible. That's people power. That's community organizing. And of course, this week in Berlin, we have the city council ruling to freeze the rent for the entire city for housing units for 5 years. So, I mean, like, you have real estate investors who are, like, just flipping their shit, like, don't know what to do. They're like, oh, like, we'll have capital flight. No one will be able to live here. And, of course, the whole city's like, this is great. Can't wait. Investments in the caring economy. Investments in the arts and housing. You know, like, exciting things are happening around the world.
Well, this is such a great example of what you're talking about, as the notion of prioritizing housing is a direct strike. A threat to the status quo, to the very profitable status quo for the 1%. And for me, just to zoom up, you know, this is a story about market failure, which for me is the theme of our entire age. The market has catastrophically failed to deal with the climate crisis, but at the very same time, it has failed to deliver universal access to essential things like housing and medicine and food for all. And so one way to understand the Green New Deal is as an interlocking set of solutions to all of these market failures. not just the failure to address the climate crisis, but all the ways in which markets are delivering cartoonish profits to the billionaire hoarding class, and for the rest of us, a life of increasing debt and crappy work and overall precariousness and anxiety and stress. So given that housing is a thing that's filling our feeds and affecting all of the people in all of our lives, paying too much for rent, a generation unable to ever even dream of owning a home, it's not surprising that this is the first part of the Green New Deal that's actually being fleshed out in concrete policies. And it's being led in the United States, as the Green New Deal conversation sort of generally is. There are now a number of bills that have come together in what's being called the People's Platform for Housing. So it's a beautiful example of an inside-outside synergy where social movement forces are defining the political demands and the policy space. The candidates who are now members of the House who came from social movements and were elected by those social movement forces are now reflecting back those demands and that politics in legislation. So this People's Platform for Housing includes venerable groups like People's Action and their now legendary Homes Guarantee campaign, a kind of, I think, a really exciting attempt to find a universal call to action that echoes Medicare for All in its basic assertion of human rights and in its immediate understandability. Like, there should be a guarantee of a home for all people. It's just that simple. So you've got that campaign. And then on the electoral side, it's great congressional figures like Pramila Jayapal from Seattle, but also the Squad. So AOC and the others all have bills in front of the Congress that, taken together as a package, call for everything from national rent control to retrofitting every unit of public housing in the United States to building millions of new units of non-market housing and taking the housing supply out of the hands of the market and the speculators and actually making the future a question of the public good, as you said. So this is the first big chunk of turf housing that the Green New Deal is taking up in policy and proposal terms. We made a little video about it, a little primer on the Green New Deal for housing. You can check it out in the show notes. And today we are excited to have a deeper conversation about this subject. And we've even managed to snag two of the foremost thinkers on housing and the Green New Deal to have it with us. So Maya, I propose that you introduce these folks and we get to it. What do you say?
I would love to. With us today, we have Daniel Aldana Cohen. He's an expert on climate politics, inequality, and cities. And he's been an absolutely essential part of developing the Green New Deal for housing. Whether helping to write the AOC Bernie Sanders housing bill, no big deal, or serving on the policy committee of the Homes Guarantee campaign, Daniel is also one of the co-authors of the new book, A Planet to Win, Why We Need a Green New Deal. We also have Kianga Yamada-Taylor, who is a formidable writer and scholar. You probably know her from one of her most famous books, From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation. Her latest book is called Race for Profit, How Banks and the Real Estate Industry Undermined Black Homeownership. And it helps us really understand, you know, how race and homeownership have gone way beyond the practice of redlining. Redlining, of course, the policies that segregate cities, to the structure of the real estate market itself. So here is our conversation with Daniel and Kianga.
Welcome to Change Everything. We are excited to talk about a Green New Deal for housing.
I'm so excited to be here.
Very glad to be here.
So Daniel, why don't you just start by laying out what a Green New Deal for housing is? Let's give the conversation like a base. What is it?
Great. Okay, thanks. Big question. So right now we have a situation of course, a climate emergency and a massive housing crisis. You know, something like 20 million American households paying over a third of their income in rent or mortgage payments, and about that many, another 20 million, more or less, paying over half of their income in monthly housing payments. So, you know, 500,000 people homeless. And at the same time, we have a climate emergency, which we know about. And the two converge, and they converge in some unexpected ways. A third of Americans can't afford their utility bills. And like all forms of inequality in the U.S., this is highly racialized. In the mid-Atlantic, where I live, about half of black families can't afford their utility bills. That means that they had a utility shutoff notice in the last few months, or they skimped on necessities, or they kept their home at an unsafe temperature. So these are kind of converging crises, and we have to tackle them together. And, you know, very briefly, the idea of a Green New Deal for housing is that it is a package of policies where you're trying to attack inequality and climate change in literally the exact same places and at the exact same time. So we're talking about building millions and millions of new units of no-carbon social housing in well-connected neighborhoods where people can take public transit, walk to daycare, walk to work, walk to the store, you know, do what they need to do and live well. We're talking about rent control so that families and people aren't displaced every time a neighborhood goes up in value. Right now, if you look at some of the biggest hotspots for gentrification in the U.S., if you look in New York, Williamsburg, Harlem, Sunset Park, increasingly South Bronx, these are the neighborhoods that have been in many ways cleaned up by environmental justice movements. And now the black and brown people who fought for decades to improve their neighborhoods are being displaced by gentrification. So we need rent control to keep people in their homes as the neighborhoods are environmentally improved. And we need to go into homes and pull out the carbon. And we especially need to focus on apartment buildings and low-income homes. We talked before, you know, working-class people and people of color not able to afford their utility bills. We need to rectify that. So fundamentally, the idea of a Green New Deal for housing, I think, is essential to tackling the housing crisis itself. It's essential to cutting carbon emissions. Homes are about a sixth of carbon emissions. But I think the Green New Deal for housing idea is also important because it is a very intuitive way of showing people, you know, just in a small number of years, how tackling the climate crisis is not an abstraction, but something that materially improves their lives. And I think that if we're going to have a 10, 20, 30-year Green New Deal process, we need to post wins very quickly and in a very clear and straightforward way.
Kianga, we have a... Now, you actually speak a lot about how there actually is not a housing crisis, per se. I'd love to hear a little bit about what you mean by that.
Sure. I mean, clearly there is... an issue with a dearth of safe, sound, and affordable housing for ordinary people. I think the point that I've tried to make with the quote-unquote housing crisis is that if for the last 100 years there has not been enough available safe, sound, and affordable housing, then this is not really a crisis, that it's a chronic feature of our society. If a crisis is meant as a breach with the otherwise normal proceeding of things, then, you know, we have to account for the fact that this has been in the United States over the course of the 20th century and certainly now into the first two decades of the 21st century, that housing insecurity has been a chronic feature of American urban life. And then for working class people, whether they are located in cities, now increasingly located in suburbs, housing insecurity has become an unfortunate factor of life for people.
Given that historical background that you have, what seems to be promising about the way this is being framed right now?
Well, I think the most promising part about it is that it's really a demand to bring the full weight of the state into these housing issues in the U.S. And this is, you know, one of the things that I've written about is the way that housing policy in the United States has always been yoked to the private sector is part of the reason why there is always a shortage of housing. The reality is that there's no money to be made in housing people affordably. There's no money to be made creating low-income, quote-unquote, affordable housing. And this is the reason why it is almost never done in the United States. And so what the Green New Deal is proposing is that we have come to terms with that, and now we are taking the creation of affordable housing out of the hands of the private sector and using the full weight and authority of the state to actually, on the scale necessary to solve this problem. So I think, you know, the plans that Sanders has talked about in terms of the creation of 10 million units of social housing, the retrofitting of public housing that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez has put at the center of her housing plans, these are all the steps that are needed to actually be able to deal with the deep issues of housing insecurity in the U.S. today.
Kianga, you said something really radical in your way, just sort of glossing over it. But like, you said that it's completely unprofitable to build a truly affordable housing. And I think it's well known in the big cities where a lot of people live, when there's a new housing development, it says, you know, there's going to be some affordable housing and the city negotiates some percentage of it. It's the system has been pre-gamed. Affordable housing is never affordable. It never addresses the number of people who need rent that they can afford or
and it's always like 16 units. Yeah. It's always some little, you know, and everybody's got their little boutique program that, you know, oh, we've got 24 units, we've got 16 units, oh, we have 103 units. It's like You need the state to be able to deal with the scale of the problem. These little cute programs that kind of work around the periphery of the problem are not enough to deal with the numbers that Daniel laid out. And we're talking about the millions of people who are impacted by housing insecurity in the U.S.
So we got to have a how we get from there to here to there question, because like we only think of housing as real estate. Like we in our culture where we live in the now, housing is exclusively a function of the market. So what is the role of the public? How does this Green New Deal for housing help us reimagine the public in this most basic thing of where people live? And that's for either both of you, everybody. Everybody on earth has to answer this. So you guys can start.
I mean, I think so. You know, Kyung is absolutely right in the sense that the current, all these inequalities that we have, inequalities of class and inequalities of race, are a feature, not a bug, of the housing system. And the housing is a market system, and it's relational. And Kyung's work has done an incredibly, you know, impressive job of showing us how it is that, you know, Black homeownership is not, generally speaking, the solution, that white home values often depend upon racism and upon the contrast, and you know, the white home values come from distance from Black home values. So we need a totally different system. In addition to all these problems that Kyunga has laid out for us, there's this more contemporary problem, which is that now proximity to transit, proximity to services, proximity to jobs, all the things that we used to associate with the inner city and stigmatize, we now think of as, you know, features of desirable dense urban living. And that now makes it so it's unaffordable for all but essentially white professionals to live a low-carbon, walkable lifestyle, right? So you have walkability is now a luxury amenity on Zillow, on Redfin, whatever, you name it. So I mean, I think, you know, let's say just very broadly speaking, like we need to take the market out in some sense of construction of housing so that we can build big, beautiful social housing, at a good cost. And places like Vienna have shown us how to do that. And then the land market itself. I mean, I think that's the other thing, the foundational issue, and this is a big issue with capitalism, is that if you apportion land uses based on ability to pay, you will have small stores annihilated by Amazon. You will have only rich people living near amenities and so on. So fundamentally, things like rent control are about soaking the excess profits out of the real estate sector. Public housing is about taking away essentially the monopoly power of big real estate. So even in a mixed economy setting, I think fundamentally the big role of the state in housing is to make this like building pens, where you might earn 5 or 6% return on investment. Good job. But you're not making 20-30% off of racism, off of your monopsony power to buy up expensive land and then only hold that for luxury condos and for speculation.
So I think that in terms of how do we get from here to there, I think this is a conversation that most people want to have. I think the problem that we have is that, you know, it's always the voices of the rich, elite, influential, and powerful that dominate these conversations. But in the same way, if you look at the debates around healthcare and universal healthcare, Americans, for the last decade, a majority of Americans have wanted some version of universal healthcare, but those opinions never pierce the mainstream media, which is dominated by the rich, powerful elite, you know, who aren't interested in that conversation, as well as the fact that we have a Congress in which, you know, the average wealth of a U.S. senator is something like $3 million. The average wealth of a person in the House of Representatives is $990,000. So if you have a government where the president says he's a billionaire, the Senate is dominated by millionaires, the House is dominated by those who are almost millionaires, then these discussions never surface, you know, make it to the surface where they actually resonate with what the majority of people in the country want to actually talk about. And, you know, this is part of the powerful intervention that Bernie Sanders' campaign has had. And the impact that it's had is that it has actually opened the space for these conversations in the mainstream. And what that has done is actually shown and demonstrated that public opinion connects with that sentiment of, you know, people want universal health care. Mm-hmm. People want to get rid of student loan debt. People want free college education. And I think that if you pose the question of using the resources of the American state to build safe, sound, and affordable housing, you would find that people want that too, because most people are either directly affected by housing insecurity or certainly know someone who is affected by housing insecurity. And if our government has the resources to give the Department of Defense almost $1 trillion a year, then certainly, there has to be money made available for healthcare, for education, and for housing people. And I think that that is a conversation that not only do people want to engage with, but that we would find is actually quite popular.
Yeah. You know, so Kianga, you're totally right, as usual. And so, you know, I'm a sociologist, but I also work with this organization, Data for Progress. And with I'm on the policy team of this housing campaign called Homes Guarantee from People's Action. Mm-hmm. And just to, I mean, and just to reinforce what you're saying and come at it a slightly different angle, we have not had a major national housing conversation in national politics in the U.S. in ages, mm-hmm. in a very long time. And this is the first year that it's happened. And how has it kind of happened? I think the main thing is that tenants' movements around the country organized with People's Action decided about a little over a year ago or a year and a half ago, they're like, we need to put housing on the agenda. We need a campaign as bold as Medicare for All, free college tuition, just like Kianga is saying, to activate this latent desire for something. And so they came up with the idea of a homes guarantee. You know, housing is a human right. Everyone should have a home. Massive new social housing construction, rent control, reparations. You could go down the list. And they got very energized. In September 5th, we put out a platform, Homes Guarantee. And within 2 weeks, basically the Bernie Sanders campaign had adopted virtually the entire thing. Bernie himself calling for a Homes Guarantee. And then suddenly, as you know, public polling is this ridiculous thing because it is ostensibly a scientific register of opinion. But what it really is projecting onto the populace, for the most part, the political preoccupations of the elite. But with Data for Progress is a little bit different. They were excited by this idea of a homes guarantee. So we started polling Americans. And guess what? Strong majority support for all of these elements. There's strong majority support for the government buying out toxic loans made to black homeowners as a form of reparations policy. You know, the big Green New Deal for housing bills, the first one is a Green New Deal for Public Housing Act. So spending, you know, tens of billions of dollars to upgrade every single public housing unit in the country, make it fully green, and create jobs for people who live in public housing. Now, you would think from watching CNN that that would be a public opinion disaster, but it pulls strong majority support. Strong majority support. People love the idea of getting the toxic mold, getting the lead out of apartments, putting people to work, apprenticeship programs for public housing residents, well over 50% support. So just changing the narrative, of course, is not enough to beat one of the biggest sectors in global capitalism. But I think it is a start. And as Kianga was saying, people really want to do something about this. All the polling that we've seen in the last few months is that they're open-minded. They love the idea of combining it with something green. Now we really have to get into the trenches and fight. But we should just all think back to a year and a half ago, mm-hmm. when a big, huge housing push from the public sector was not on the agenda. And if I had said to you, you know, Avi and Maya, obviously you know better, but I think most of us, if we'd been at a dinner party and said, oh, we're going to put green guaranteed housing on the agenda, they'd say, oh, well, that's a great idea, but it'll pull at 3%. Mm-hmm. But it pulls really well. People want to solve these problems. And I don't think, and nobody trusts, who trusts the private sector? I mean, if you're rich, you trust the real estate sector to deliver you a retirement. Mm-hmm. Other than that,
Because everybody's been screwed over by the real estate sector and the banking sector. I mean, 10 million people lost their homes in the 2008 housing crisis. And all of those people and the general public watched the government bend over backwards to bail out banks. Mm. They watched these people crash the economy, almost crash the global economy, and not a single one of them were held to account for it. In fact, they got paid off for it. And so everyone knows that. And to me, the importance of the polling data is not just numbers for numbers' sake, but that it helps to create an opening to have this discussion in the mainstream. It helps people feel like they're not the only ones who think this. It helps them feel like this is not a pipe dream. If 50% more of the American public think this is a good idea, then maybe this is not just some pie in the sky thing that I should just keep to myself. Maybe this is something that we can actually demand. Maybe this is something that we can actually mobilize around. And it says to the elected officials that perhaps this is something that we have to take seriously. And so having this issue and all of these other issues that Sanders has helped bring to the mainstream as a part of the public discussion helps to create pressure that, of course, we have to then mobilize around, we have to organize around, but the discussion is part of this entire reorientation in U.S. society right now.
I think for so long we've been waiting for, I mean, I definitely have been waiting for the normalization of the Green New Guillotine. Right? That's what I'm saying, right? Summing up what we're talking about. Yeah, let's do it.
Actually, I think you just premiered it on the show here, Maya.
Petitioned to change the title of the show.
Accepted. Passed overwhelmingly.
Wonderful.
Unanimous.
But, you know, when we're talking about what it means to, like, how the private sector has just screwed over, caused so much death and destruction and turmoil, and that idea, that understanding actually being really normalized and people really being, there's a certain ease that people are addressing that issue now and feeling comfortable talking about. What do you see the role of the private sector being when we're actually talking about what a Green New Deal for housing would be? You know, like, would all new housing be public? Would all the jobs in new housing be public? So what do you feel the role of the private sector would be if we're reimagining this framework?
I was just in my neighborhood the other day thinking about this. There's like a new subdivision going up near us. And I'm thinking, okay, let's say we win as suddenly as these ideas have become normalized and are being entertained. Do we stop private developments that are already? No, we can't. How could we scale up the public infrastructure to do it in the speed necessary? Somehow there has to be a transition that involves the private sector. Doesn't there? You statist socialist guests on our on our podcast?
I mean, to be honest, I feel like these are real trick questions because there are a lot of people who get mad at what we say and a very small number of people about to take the streets for a really well thought out apportionment of public and private roles here. I mean, I think like the thing, one of the
what
things.
What do we want? A mixed economy. When do we, whenever.
Soon,
like,
ish.
Ish.
When it feels good.
I think, you know, I think one of the, again, like so many incredible contributions Kianga has been making, but one of them is to, I think another one, is to point out that the racist housing system we have now is not just a public kind of like pathology. And that's, that argument about redlining has been made. Redlining is about a mortgage system, and yet somehow many liberals have made it out as if redlining is the pure and unique contribution of the government's role in housing. And I see in Kianga's work a demonstration that in different ways throughout the decades, housing segregation and racism have been a public-private partnership all throughout, and the balance of those two has changed somewhat. So we have to take the private sector out of the driver's seat. Now, if you look at something like Red Vienna, where the public sector is building, you know, in, at that time in the 20s, you know, housing for, I think, 80,000 people. Now a third of the housing in Vienna is public and a third is cooperative. But what you see is, so the public takes charge. They say, we're going to build these buildings. But they do have contracts. And they make, I think what's interesting, and not maybe exactly the role of the private sector per se, what we're asking the private sector to do. So you have entire companies that grow up in Austria that are only producing like doorknobs or doors or something. At the same time, there was a decision in Vienna that was, we have all these craftsmen who are unemployed. So we're going to put them to work on the outside of the buildings. So the best architects will compete for the contracts to create the buildings, but under certain specifications. Now, socialist modernist in Germany were like, oh, public, you know, the new modernist housing should have no frills. It should be totally austere, just straight lines.
It must be grim if it's public housing. Mm-hmm.
And in Vienna, they're like, I don't know, maybe in theory, but we have all these craftsmen, so why don't we put them to work? So I think there's a big difference between a public-private partnership where the private sector gets all the benefits, the public sector bears the risk, and the private sector's vision of society prevails versus contracts given out from the public sector, very closely supervised. And to be honest, if you talk about a Green New Deal for housing, building a million units a year, yeah, in the first few years, the public sector will build very few of those because we don't have public housing construction companies. But that doesn't mean we can't make them. And it also doesn't mean that those private companies don't turn into cooperatives that are financed by public banks and so on. So I think that there is a wide variety of institutional forms, but the coordination, the control has to be on the public side. And I think we do need some anti-corruption mechanisms in place. That's not really like
FDR invented place, whole departments of auditors to make sure that there's isn't corruption in big new public contracting. It doesn't seem unreasonable. But I want to get to Kianga. Your book really blew my mind in understanding this public private partnership of racism in America. And so, given that historical work that you've done, can you help us think through how a Green New Deal for housing could help us escape from the racism baked into the economy through the housing system, which is really what you document? And like, what would be the measures or principles that could undo so much of what has been locked in through housing in terms of white supremacy in America in all of these industrialized countries?
What it means is we'd have to think through the regulations on the private sector. And most importantly now, I think it means thinking through and following through on an enforcement regime that forces the private sector to actually abide by the rules and regulations as they're written into law now. So we think about something like fair housing. You know, the Fair Housing Act was passed in 1968. And when it was passed, it created a civil rights division within HUD. It was given $6 million to begin to actually enforce fair housing. But $5 million of those dollars went to staffing, which left $1 million for 120 employees to enforce civil rights laws in housing for the entire United States. So that was never a serious effort to actually
deal. That's pretty much a demonstration of the level of the commitment
No, exactly. And so all those things would have to change. Like, there would have to be some commitment to actually following through on the law. And that, you know, that is the promise of what a Sanders or Sanders-like administration holds for people, is that there would actually be some commitment to follow through on the laws that already exist to protect working class people, and certainly to protect black and brown people in the housing market. But this is not an easy road to hoe.
It's not easy. and of course, I mean, just like you were saying, you know, go back to the 30s, even then the real estate industry, the initial vision in the Public Works Administration was public housing as a public option, no income ceiling, high quality housing. In fact, lower income people couldn't afford to get in. And the real estate industry fights back. And then ultimately from 37 onward, right, you know, the public housing only allowed to be built for the essentially people too poor to access the private market with very limited amounts of money per unit. Because, you know, you would think the real estate sector would say to you, oh, you know, the public housing, we just can't have it. They won't build good quality housing. In fact, they're terrified of the competition. They know the public sector would do a good job if it was well-resourced. I guess my concern for now, and I hear everything that you're saying, Kianga, and I think we, at some other day when we're getting ultra wonky, we should talk about New Jersey because they have this great, the best fair housing laws, but that's because of basically multiracial union, racial justice, civil rights organizing, some success. But I think the core issue from a climate perspective is that you can't have what the private sector loves to do the most, which is to build two big houses in suburban sprawling subdivisions, right? That's the homes that are built right now are luxury condos, which is a social disaster, and extremely large suburban homes, which are also a climate disaster. And we need to be building essentially apartment buildings of a high quality. And that is already, it's already, from a green perspective, you can essentially build affordable green housing at the same cost as non-green. But you essentially need to build apartment buildings near transit and on valuable land. And that's where I really see the private sector just not doing it. I mean, to the extent they're building condo towers, they're the luxury. So it may be that with the right mix of incentives and tax breaks and shifting, we can have a lot of the new housing built by the private sector. But even that will require, like Kianga was saying, massive intervention into the market. And I think that is the strongest case for social housing, is the multifamily apartment buildings.
This is kind of bringing us to this point that we've been keen to talk to you both about, which is, you know, how do we, if we're going to have all these investments, we're going to build new apartment buildings, we're going to have to build them differently. How are we avoiding a commodity boom? You know, is it possible to do all of this without deepening disaster in communities? We've been talking a lot about how, of course, when we talk about a Green New Deal, specifically in the global north, there's a lot of excitement about what a just transition means. But of course, we're not talking about the fact that a just transition or the building of all these new homes is actually going to require extraction the likes of which we've never seen before. And we're not really talking about how that will affect communities at the point of extraction. So how do we kind of bring this into a global, almost Green New Deal frame and try and avoid that commodity boom as best we can?
I actually was hanging out last night with a good friend of mine, Steph Carlisle, who is her specialty is carbon emissions accounting of building materials. We talk about this stuff all the time, and it is actually one.
Wow, you really do. You just hang out with the wonks. They just flock together, don't they?
I love carbon.
Wow.
We flock. Yeah, exactly. And you know what? Like, you can sustainable wood is coming. Sustainable wood isn't about the wood itself. It's about forestry. It's replanting the forest. And in Oregon, you're having really interesting conversations. We're talking about insulating. I mean, this is the level of wonkery. Is like, oh, how are you going to insulate the buildings? What's the right kind of non-toxic foam? And it turns out that now we're talking about combining regenerative agriculture, cutting up these grasses, drying them, treating them with non-toxic materials like boron, and you can essentially create insulation out of like compressed grasses into these kind of like bioboards. There's all kinds of stuff happening. And the thing about it is this, and we could talk about like no carbon cement is kind of slowly coming online, but we need all these new innovations in materials because people are going to need to live somewhere. So I don't think the solution is not to give them homes. All the no carbon ways we can build, we can activate with public procurement. The private sector is the last sector. The guys who build McMansions in suburbs, those guys are not asking themselves, oh, what's the way to build in a most sustainable possible way? They're not asking that question, but we can ask that question. So I want to flip it around and say, what possible chance do you have of building no carbon homes that are not extractive, that are not materially intensive, but that actually are part of the green economy? What chance do you have of doing that without the public sector being in charge? I see none.
Take another run at this same question. We make a political argument, and I think among the people on this in this chat, we have a consensus that we need to deliver material benefits to people who are suffering in order to build the political will to actually take on the forces necessary to have a Green New Deal. And so we're very focused on creating jobs and creating housing and creating transit that works and healthcare that people don't have to pay for and go into debt for and education without debt. What we're saying is that if we do it at the scale and speed we're talking about, it implies, given that there is a transition period where we need to use existing supply chains, where we need to work within the world that we live in, an extraction boom is particularly in the global south, where communities are already suffering the apocalypse of the globalized consumption economy because of the raw resources that are being ripped out of their lands. And it's not just in the global south because of, you know, Vancouver Island, the trees and the gravel and the construction materials fueled California's housing boom. That's largely unceded territory. And so all around us, we are taking stuff out of the ground to do this. And we're talking about in the Green New Deal, a huge expansion of built environment. And how do we reconcile that with the fact that right now extraction is genocidal in some places in the world?
But just quickly, we're not talking, I take the point and I accept the premise of the question, but I also contest it because part of what we're talking about is shifting away from a model of wildly wasteful, hyper-privatized consumption and construction toward a far more rational, public, and sustainable model. So the private sector builds 1.3 million units of housing a year. And they're McMansions, and they're luxury condos. And if we're building green, affordable housing, much more in the vein of apartments and giant McMansions, we're going to use actually far fewer materials. And when we do that, we're also going to use the public sector to ensure that those processes, we decarbonize the entire supply chain and make it sustainable. And again, absent the public sector, all you're having is the waste economy. And with transportation, we can talk about the same thing. We're talking about not building miles and miles of highways to support more and more and more and more subdivisions. So I think the Green New Deal gets tarred as, oh, you're going to do this massive stimulus with irresponsibly. It's more like a far more responsible transformation of the economic activity that was already going to happen and shifting it from privatized and waste to collective and subject to a transformative vision of even how to do this building in the first place.
I would just add two things to that. One is, I think the scale of building is one aspect of this. I think there's also the aspect of retrofitting existing housing. In metropolitan areas, that is also an important aspect of this. So no one is saying that we should tear down the existing public housing that exists in the United States and rebuild from scratch. Although, you know, it's undeniable that there would need to be new building. But it's also about how do we transform the existing housing that is already here. The second part, I think, is internationalism. How do we do these things in collaboration, coordination, and conversation with our political allies and comrades in the South? And that also, the entire possibility of this relies on a different configuration of politics. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't just take the existing structures and systems now and talk about the restructuring of not the entire U.S., but of significant portions of it. So this is all in concert with an understanding that there have to be political transformations. And that includes the political relationship that exists now between the North and the South. That is something that also has to change.
I'm excited about getting started ripping up trade agreements for starters. And reimagining that architecture.
So. But just quickly, like we can't put ourselves in a situation where people feel there's a shortage of housing when the U.S. needs to accept tens of millions of more immigrants, especially as we come toward the end of the century.
Right.
And you know, up to 13 million displaced from sea level rise alone. 2 million people in California live in extreme fire danger. And 4.5 million Americans overall live in extreme fire danger. So what are the conditions under which the next great migration, which is coming, is not traumatic and does not reinforce Jim Crow segregation? The conditions for that have to be that we are creating, in a sustainable way, but we are creating new housing that is social, that doesn't have a vision of scarcity, but is a vision of rebuilding and in many ways improving community amenities for everybody who's moving around, whether that's Americans who are moving where they live from other parts of the country or people coming in from other countries. And just on the point of retrofit, that's absolutely right. And Kyunga and I are working with a great candidate in Philadelphia, Nikhil Saval. He's running for state senate in central PA. And one of the planks he's running on is this idea that Philadelphia has 25,000 vacant homes, mostly row homes, and we can retrofit those, put them into community land trusts, mm-hmm. make them environmental, sustainable, virtually no energy use, and that can create 125,000 spots of permanently non-market housing. Baltimore has a great campaign, United Workers, who are also fighting for retrofitting, you know, vacant or very dilapidated homes and putting them into community land trusts. So that's absolutely right. I mean, the retrofit part is central. And I think the thing with the Green New Deal is it's a lot of abstractions. Once you get down to the nuts and bolts, it turns out that you can come up with really good ideas. Again, once you get the profit imperative, put that to the side, and then you have like smart people with good politics, you know, a lot of good possibilities open up.
So, like, speaking of good people with good politics, I think it would be really interesting to hear from both of you what your, you know, with the possibility of a Bernie win on the horizon. Mm. What do you think you're...
Don't even say it out loud.
You said it out
loud. What are you doing?
Yeah, it's a great deal for Green New Guillotine, Bernie win, all the things are on the table. what would your call to action, you know, it can be so overwhelming for the public, you know, we are normalizing this concept of like what housing for all would mean, what it would look like, what it means when we're talking about migration and access to services. But what is the first step? I mean, if you were going to speak to somebody who's like, this is happening, here's the first thing you can do. What would your call to action to people be? That's a question for both of you.
To me, the biggest issue would be when are we planning our first mass march on the U.S. Congress? And what are our you know, I guess part of that would be what are our initial demands. And so, you know, that to me is has to be an essential part of this entire effort to get Sanders into the White House.
I think that's something that preoccupies me is if you look at the right, they pour a huge amount of money into the organizational infrastructure. We need on the left to create institutional spaces for long-term interaction between essentially experts, working people, community organizers, community members, and to gradually like dissolve that boundary.
You know, and this is something that the left, you know, I'll speak just in this country, grapples with, right? That it's not just the mobilization, it's not just the protests, but it's what do we want? And we have to have the institutional spaces, and we haven't created those kinds of spaces, enough of them, to really be able to do all the things that we want to do and to really think through and map out what these plans could actually look at. And that's the difference between being outside of government and then being in the position to govern, right? And that's what we have to start thinking about as the ideas of reform, social democracy, socialism become much more influential. Then you're not just on the outside opposing something, you have the potential to be inside. And governing is a much more complicated set of responsibilities. And we have to prepare ourselves for that.
In that spirit of preparing ourselves, I want to bring the conversation back to housing in this final thought and the spiritual and emotional dimension of home, which I think is absent of a lot in both the technocratic conversations and in the political and strategic conversations. Right now, home is the source of wealth, is the ultimate expression of ownership in the ownership society in which we live in the rich world. And we're talking about home. How do we talk about home? And how do we capture that essential feeling of home, which is not grounded in this imprinted idea of the individual nuclear family, but is somehow a radical and a project of liberation of a collective? Because I think the sort of feeling of home has to change too if we're going to fight for a home globally that feels and looks different.
Well, I actually think about this question a lot, and that essentially home is about relationships, a sense of belonging, a sense of refuge, and a very elemental sense of solidarity between people. And that, you know, is something that people carry with them. The problem is that it can become imperiled when the physical structures that we reside in are precarious, or when they are constantly under threat, or when they're violently stripped away from us. And so part of this is about how do we create the conditions where those bonds of connection and solidarity and belonging that exist between people can be made permanent by removing the threat of housing insecurity. How can they become even connected to the place that people are residing in? But I do think that trying to connect with that deeper meaning of connection and what it means to be from a place is also part of how we mobilize people around these issues.
I think to take this question of sort of feeling secure in one's home, I mean, I think it, as Kiang was saying, it has a ton to do with community. And I think on the one hand, we overestimate how much certain kinds of housing can provide that. Like a lot of work by feminist, but not just feminist scholars, find, you know, suburban housing, especially for the people who don't have a job during the day, can be extremely isolating.
Yeah.
Alienating. And on the flip side, people are very shocked often when people in public housing, even in very difficult conditions as they're in the U.S., fight to stay in that housing because of the community. And what they want to do is really upgrade and improve the housing. And so I do think this gets us back to the Green New Deal idea of a bit more density, But we really have to think about this as a project of urban and community transformation. And I think to think about housing, as Kanga was saying, as it's not just a box in a square floating out there, right? It's really a node in a community. And the left has always been accused of just wanting to build these low-quality shacks, and nothing could be further from the truth. And the last point, I think, is security. Is essential. There's this amazing Channel 4, just British TV documentary about, short documentary about social housing in Vienna, and they talk to this father and his daughter, and they say, well, don't you wish you could own your own apartment? And he's like, this building has everything. And they show they have like ceramics classes at night, swimming pools on the roof and the floor, tennis, you know, everything. It's like, this building has everything, and the rent is very cheap, and it's guaranteed. And if they ever tried to change it, we would just destroy the government. So why do I own it? Why do I want to own it? What difference does it make to me? Like, I'm here, I'm safe, it's a beautiful place.
So
I think, you know, exactly to the points we're all making, like the conflation of home ownership of any sort and a sense of home, I don't think even most people experience that luxury. And that is the opportunity that we have, is to, work on that desire for a home with connectivity and security and safety. And if I think most people are going to get that, it's going to have to require a fundamentally different system.
I think that's a fantastic way to wrap us up. We're so grateful to you, Kianga and Daniel, for joining us.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you. So excited. Let's leap forward. Let's get there.
You know, I really love when we get so many nerds in a room, just really nerding out. That was so
nerd concentration
fascinating.
High.
Nerd concentration very high. Avi, how was that interview for you? Tell me what you're thinking.
Oh, just loved that conversation. A moment of deep appreciation for just being part of a movement where some of our most important thinkers get excited about breaking down the silos between organizers and progressive technocrats.
Synergy, if you will.
but seriously, like to teasing Daniel lovingly, I think that the desperate need for spaces to shape demands, like a collective and democratic proposal and policy space, is really vital. And the question that that Kianga raised of confronting the necessity of being ready to govern is one that we have to take seriously, even though, you know, we hardly dare to breathe it aloud. It is a vital conversation that we need to have.
It's so important, and people are so ill-prepared to have it. I don't think very many people, especially in organizing spaces and political organizing spaces, are really thinking about what happens if we win.
Yeah.
What actually has to happen? What has to roll out? Do we understand how all of these really complex mechanisms need to be in conversation with each other? How will the best plan that we have to offer, how will it impact people differently? Really think it all the way through. And I think that we know in no uncertain terms and with great clarity and, well-spokenness, what we're against. But what are we for? What are the solutions that we're putting forward?
Well, and this is, even going back to the globalization debate of the late 90s, this is the stick that the liberal technocrats have always beat us with. Governing is complicated. We're the grown-ups in the room. It's a balancing of all these different interests and threading the needle of blah, 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 pragmatism. Now what we've done to the planet is forcing transformational change onto the agenda. And we all have to confront, if we're actually serious about what it will take and the speed of the changes required, we're now in new terrain. And so now we have movements coming together around truly transformative demands, and nobody knows how to implement those. We have to look to history, to wartime, to other metaphors that have all their own sets of problems to actually figure out what that means. But the conversation, must happen. The other thing that I loved about that conversation is just a reminder that the Green New Deal really is a frame that keeps on giving. This connection between our collective survival and our collective liberation. Between the transformations that are required to keep people safe, both on the planet, and in our daily lives. People need rent control and building improvements that don't gentrify them out of their neighborhoods. And buildings are a major source of emissions, and they need to be retrofitted for that reason as well. And we have to connect these priorities. They're already connected. With your indulgence, I just want to talk about capital allocation for a second.
Oh, my God.
Is that okay? Okay, you said nerdy, so... Okay, so we live in a global financialized economy. The economy is super financialized, and hedge funds and private equity control these vast lakes of capital. And they allocate this capital to speculation and to hoarding, right? And to the Wall Street casino and to share buybacks and to the parallel, you know, offshore economy. And real estate is a perfect example of that. It almost crashed the global economy 10 years ago. And we desperately need those lakes of capital to be allocated to productive uses, to transforming our daily lives and all of our societal systems to be both carbon-free and oppression-free. And so it's this feeling where rent strikes, you know, and climate strikes are both tools in the Green New Deal toolbox. And, you know, we have to see the connection between these things.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was fighting the urge to say, yeah, rent strikes, climate strikes, guillotines. All three okay. Completely valid things in the toolbox.
It.
Thank you. Just one more time. Third time for the podcast. But, you know, the thing you're saying really is like sticking out for me about, you know, liberal elites like bashing us over the head, which like you don't understand that some people are just going to have to suffer. And that's just the world, the way the world is. And you're so idealistic. And like, friends, that's garbage. That's like really hot garbage. And suffering is profitable. We know that suffering is profitable. We know that we have the money to pay for this. We know in which offshore bank accounts it's sitting in. We know that we don't actually have to have homelessness in fucking 2020. And I think that I went on this like big Twitter rant the other day about like all these people, all these racist people freaking out about the coronavirus. And they're like, oh, my God, we need like gloves and masks. And you're like, number one, it's the flu. Number two, the biggest thing that you can do to keep communities healthy is investing in housing, in transit, in healthcare. Like, what are the reasons that people come to work sick? Because one day missed at work for so many people means food, means childcare, means rent. If you're one paycheck away from being homeless, of course you're going to get sick faster. Of course you're going to be stressed out all the time. You know, this really, really what we're saying when we're saying some people don't deserve housing is we're furthering and expanding the attack on the poor, cracking down on everything from fare evaders, because we know, of course, that paying for public transit is basically a poverty tax. Everything from fare evasion in transit systems to pushing people into housing that is precarious and unsafe to forcing people out into the street to sleep and then criminalizing them for sleeping there is a coordinated attack on poor people. And this, you know, this decision about who is worthy of surviving, who's worthy of dignity is really the first wave of climate breakdown. And so climate organizers, especially if you're new to the scene, this is a shout out and a call out for you. We absolutely have to treat the anti-poverty movement as part of the climate movement, because it is part of the climate movement and it always has been. We need to unite in the attacks on the austerity attacks on poor people. We need to fight the systematic pushing of folks into precarity. And we really need to foundationally, in every aspect of our organizing work, out public and out loud, reject the politics of scarcity and sacrifice every single way we see it.
This is so true. And it is. And I felt this at the end of our conversation with Daniel and Kianga, that we were starting to zoom out to talk about safety and who gets to feel safe and how we create that sense of home is the place where you feel safe. And this is where it connects back out to the climate breakdown, you know, that our collective home is unsafe. And that is so destabilizing. And the amount of climate grief and anxiety that people are really starting to feel on a mass level is a reflection of the fact that we don't feel safe in our home. And this is there's nothing more destabilizing. And so the experience of the poorest people in the economy and the people that neoliberalism has been systematically discarding for decades and decades is starting to universalize through the effects of this economic system. And everybody is starting to feel what it feels like to be unsafe. And this is really the fight for climate justice, to make a home, a collective home for everyone that feels safe. And it's the fight of our lives to make it safe for everyone. So this conversation about home, I think, is a foundational one, a beautiful conversation.
If you like this podcast and all the things we're throwing into it, please support us on Patreon. We're so incredibly grateful for the really generous monthly supporters who've been giving to Change Everything. So we want to give you a quick shout out. You're the reason why this show gets to continue the way that it does. A special thank you to John Wilson, Kevin Delaney, Heather Ashdown, Donald Cole, and Janali Davis. And if you'd like to support us on Patreon, you can. Just go to www.patreon.com/changeeverything.
This episode of Change Everything was produced by Rajiv Sikora and edited and mixed by Jeremy Kessler and Brad Tigwell. Change Everything was developed with Andrea Schmidt at What Escapes Productions.